Benzai busted? He doesn't look familiar, though. Calloway opened the door. Lee Calloway? The man asked. Can I help you? Calloway replied, hesitantly. My name is Dr. Richard Lester. Calloway just looked at him. I am Sharon Gardner's brother, Dr. Lester said. Oh, Calloway said. So that would make Kyla Gardner your niece. Yes, Dr. Lester replied. Calloway wanted to invite him inside for a seat, but his office did not give off the best impression. What can I do for you? He asked, as he stepped out and closed the door behind him. I know you're a busy man, so I won't take too much of your time. Okay, Calloway said. Nice he thinks I'm busy as a bee, Calloway thought. But I've got all the time in the world. Dr. Lester cleared his throat. I'm here about the photos you took for my brother-in-law, Paul. Calloway squinted. What about them? I'm interested to know what's in those photos. I'm sorry, but that's privileged information. I cannot tell you what's in those photos without Mr. Gardner's okay. Dr. Lester did not seem offended by Calloway's direct response. My sister was very upset that her activities on that particular night were made public, he said. We don't want the actual photos to get out either. I understand your concern, but my client hired me to take them. Whatever he does with them is his choice. If I were you, I'd speak to him, Calloway said. I would, but right now, due to tragic circumstances, we are not on speaking terms. So I heard, Calloway said. Nice family, abandoning an in-law to sink or swim, he thought. I would be willing to buy them off you. Name your price, Mr. Calloway, Dr. Lester said. Calloway grimaced. Sure, I need the bucks, he thought, but client confidentiality is set in stone for me. I'm sorry you wasted your time coming here, he said, but those photos are not for sale. Dr. Lester was unfazed. He put his hand inside his pants pocket and pulled out a business card. Well, if you change your mind, I'll make it worth your while. Chapter 45. Roth was once again seated across from Paul in his mother's house. Roth was preparing for another case when Paul called him. He sounded hysterical and upset, constantly wailing, I want this nightmare to end. Roth worried his client was going to do something stupid, so he rushed over. Fortunately, Paul was composed when he arrived at the door. His mother had given him one of her anxiety medications to calm him down. As he stared at him, Roth could not help but see a man who looked more like a scared boy. Paul wore a t-shirt, and his track pants were white. But Roth could see coffee stains on them. He had stubble on his cheeks, and his hair was sprouting in all directions. Roth would have to clean him up before he presented him to the jury. There was no way he would let anyone see him like this. Paul rubbed his hands together. He avoided making eye contact, but Roth could see his pupils were dilated. Maybe it was the effects of the medication, or maybe it was the medication combined with the alcohol that was causing his eyes to look that way. Paul reeked of booze. There was no telling how many bottles he had consumed. Roth would have to ask his mother. I'm sorry that you had to drive over here because of me, Paul said. I'm here whenever you need me, Roth replied. It's all billable hours, he thought. Paul nodded. Roth said, You told me on the phone that you wanted this nightmare to end. What did you mean by that?
My daughter is dead. My wife has abandoned me. My reputation is in tatters. My life is destroyed.
It can all be redeemed once you are found not guilty.
How long will that take? Paul asked, finally looking at him. I can't go back to my own house because of all the attention. I can't even leave my mom's house without reporters following me. Even my mom is constantly being harassed by them.
I can ask the Milton PD to make them stop bothering her.
Why can't you make them leave me alone, too?
The media wants a story, and you are a person of interest in a horrible crime. Your mom, on the other hand, has nothing to do with what happened. They can't force her to talk to them.
They were quiet a moment. Paul said, When can I see my daughter's body?
I put in a request,
but your wife, as the next of kin, won't allow it.
I'm her father. I'm also her next of kin.
Yes, but you are charged with murdering her.
Paul shook his head. This is not right. I may be charged, but I haven't been found guilty. Can't we get a judge to grant me access to see my daughter?
We can try, but in my opinion, it would be a waste of time. Even if we went ahead with it, I could almost guarantee a judge will side with your wife. She's also a victim in all of this.
Paul blinked. A victim?
Let me rephrase that. She is the victim's mother. I can bet the prosecution will use her against you to show that you were a horrible father, that you never got along with your daughter, and that you had a motive to kill her.
I didn't, Paul said.
Regardless, when a jury sees a grieving mother on the stand, weeping about the loss of her child, an only child, I might add, they will sympathize with her pain. And to make matters worse, you and she were on the verge of a separation, so I highly doubt she'd hold back any vitriol against you.
Paul's head fell to his chest.
My advice to you is to stop watching the news, to stay indoors as much as possible, and to keep your mind occupied with things other than what happened. It's going to be some time before we go to trial, and I can't have you falling apart. And trust me, the media will be bored of you the moment something else catches their attention.
Chapter 46. After the visit from Dr. Lester, Calloway decided to leave his office and walk down to the bar around the corner. He was still thinking about the offer Lester had made him. The doctor would have paid far more than what Paul had given him, but it came down to principle. Paul was his client, and his loyalty was to him and no one else. There were many times when cheating spouses of his clients had tried to buy him out. They would make personal visits or go through their lawyers. Their main objective was to make sure the information did not become public, or that the information did not make it into the hands of their spouses. Their offer would be double or even triple what he received from his clients. The more damning the evidence, the more money they were willing to throw at him. Calloway was not a blackmailer. He despised even being referred to as one. Right after he was hired for a job, he usually had no idea what he would dig up. And when he did, he forwarded that information to his client. If that client used it to blackmail their husband or wife, that was up to them. It did not change the price Calloway charged for his services. Now, if the client was gracious to give him a bonus, or let him stay at her beach house rent-free, that was something extra. He never demanded free perks. There were a couple of times where Calloway had to return the money, because he did not feel compelled to finish the job. Once, a woman came to him and said she was certain her husband had another family she was not aware of. Calloway took on the case and followed the husband. He discovered the husband was indeed meeting another woman, but she turned out to be his half-sister. They had found each other through social media. The husband was embarrassed that his deceased father had a child out of wedlock, so he hid his half-sister's existence from his wife. He also feared that if his wife found out, she would tell his mother, whom she did not get along with. His mother, a cancer survivor, would be devastated that his father had been unfaithful in their marriage. The husband was waiting for the right time to break the news to his mother. Calloway decided to keep the information to himself and refunded the wife. He walked into the restaurant and headed straight to the bar. He ordered a drink, and he spotted someone familiar in a booth by the window. He grabbed his glass and went over. "Mind if I join you?" he asked. Fisher looked at him. "What if I said no?" "I would still sit down, but then it would be very awkward." She smiled and took a sip from her drink. "Aren't you still on duty?" he asked.
"It's cranberry juice," she replied.
"Mine is 4% alcohol," he said, holding up his glass.
"Glad to know," she said. He looked around.
"What brings you all the way here? I'm sure there are nicer places to get a drink near the Milton PD.
"I just wanted to get away."
"From Holt?" he said. "I don't blame you. The man is anal as they come."
"He's not so bad," she said. "He's actually a very good detective. I've learned a lot from him.
Calloway grinned. And what have you learned from me?
To stay away from guys like you.
And what's wrong with guys like me?
They think they can do whatever they want in life, and that it doesn't have any repercussions.
What have I done? He asked, feigning surprise.
She shook her head and took another sip from her glass.
Is this about Patty? He asked.
Fisher had a theory that Calloway was still in love with his ex-wife. She believed he did not feel worthy of a woman like her, and that was why he was jumping from one relationship to another.
How's Nina?
Fisher asked instead of replying to Calloway's question. Have you gone to see her yet?
As a matter of fact, I did, and we had ice cream.
How is she?
Growing up fast.
They do when you don't pay too much attention.
Okay, I get your point.
They were quiet a moment.
How's the investigation going? He asked.
Which one?
The Gardner case?
It's coming along.
That's not what I heard.
What have you heard?
I heard you guys don't have enough evidence to send him to prison for a very long time.
And where did you hear that?
I read it online.
Don't believe everything you read, especially online, she said.
Is it true or not?
She stared at him and decided to come clean.
We don't have enough yet,
but we'll find it. Holt won't stop until he does.
He is convinced Paul Gardner is guilty?
Calloway asked.
She nodded.
And what about you? He asked.
Do you think he's guilty?
She shrugged. So far, all signs point to him, and until I see something otherwise, I'm inclined to think so, too.
Do you mind letting me see what you got on him? He asked.
She laughed. You know I can't do that. We are only supposed to let Gardner's defense see what we have against him. If you are so inclined, you can ask his lawyer. By the way, why are you suddenly so interested? I thought you completed the job he hired you for.
I did. It's just that he doesn't come across as a killer to me.
They never do, until they end up committing the crime.
Calloway could not argue with that.
Chapter 47. Fisher returned to the Milton PD. She found Holt waiting at her desk. He had a smile on his face.
What's up? She asked. Where have you been? I called you several times.
She checked her phone and saw she had many missed calls. I had to meet a friend.
Was it Lee Calloway? He asked.
How'd you know?
Call it a wild guess. I thought you were done with him.
I am, but still, how did you know I met him?
When you said you were driving to Chinatown, I know his office is around there. I figured you'd run into him.
I did.
You should be careful with him, Holt warned her. He screwed us when he took those photos of Sharon Gardner.
No, he just gave us proof that she was lying to us.
Holt scowled. Because of those photos, Gardner got bail.
He would have gotten bail regardless. His lawyer would have seen to it. Fisher shot back.
I don't know about that.
Roth gets big bucks for keeping his client out of jail. He would have pulled a lot of strings to make sure Gardner didn't spend another minute in a cell.
Holt pondered her words. All I'm saying is that Calloway was instrumental in the outcome. He works for our suspect, so that makes him our enemy.
Fisher laughed. No, it doesn't. Gardner hired him for a job, and he did it. He doesn't work for him anymore.
Okay, sure, he said, not believing her.
Why were you smiling when I came in? She asked.
The smile reappeared on his face. He held out an envelope for her. The fingerprint analysis came back from the lab.
Fisher grabbed it, pulled out a sheet of paper, and read the report. Her eyes suddenly widened in astonishment. Holt was now grinning from ear to ear.
Gardner's prints are on the knife that was found in his Audi. On top of that,
the blood on the knife matched the victim's, Fisher said, completing his sentence.
Bingo.
Fisher stared at the report.
You look disappointed, Holt said.
I'm not, she replied. I just figured Gardner would be smarter than that.
What do you mean?
We found no blood anywhere in the house except for Kyla's bedroom. It's reasonable to assume that he may have wiped the house clean of any evidence. So? So why didn't he wipe the knife after he hid it? Maybe he never expected anyone to find it. But there was blood on the door of the Audi, which led us to the knife in the first place. Holt shrugged. Maybe he got careless. Something still doesn't feel right, Fisher thought. I can't argue with a lab report, though. Holt picked up the phone and punched in a number. You're calling the DA?
I already told her. Barrows is beyond ecstatic. But I think we need to turn up the heat on Gardner.
So who are you calling?
The Milton Inquirer.
She was surprised. Why?
Even with the knife in our possession, Gardner refused a plea deal. He had to have known we would eventually match his prints. And the blood on the knife could only have come from the victim. I bet he knows something we don't. He must have an ace up his sleeve.
Fisher sighed. You're giving him too much credit.
He is far more cunning than he looks, Holt said. I have a contact, the Milton Inquirer. He will relay the fingerprints report to the press as an anonymous tip. Let's see how Gardner handles it when the entire city knows he did it.
Chapter 48. Calloway was back at his office when he checked his voicemail. There was a message from Mike Grabonski. Mike had secured a buyer for his investment property. The price was not as high as he had hoped, but with creditors on his back, Mike was grateful to unload the property. He felt an obligation to tell Calloway and was grateful for what he had done for him. Calloway felt it should be him thanking Mike. The $5,000 went a long way in helping him clear up his debts, too. Sometimes, his job enabled him to do some good for a change. There were only so many cheaters he could follow. Mike was a decent person, who got caught in a situation he did not know how to get out of. When Baxter came looking for him, his primal instincts of fight or flight kicked in. He chose the latter option. Neither made for a good choice. Mike could never have taken on Baxter if he chose to fight him, and sooner or later, Baxter would have found him anyway. The best option, the one Calloway took, was to go back and work out a deal that was beneficial to everyone. It required some clever maneuvering, but Mason got his money, Calloway got his fee, and Mike got back to his family in one piece. Calloway turned on the TV. He froze when he saw who was on the screen. Sharon Gardner stood in front of a large house. Calloway recognized it as her brother's. Next to Sharon was Senator Baron Lester, her father. He had his arm around her shoulders. Microphones and tape recorders were pushed in front of her. What the hell? Calloway thought as he turned up the volume. Senator Lester spoke first.
We were just informed of new information that has surfaced regarding the death of my granddaughter, Kyla. We have further confirmed this information with the Milton Police Department, and I have to say it is true. My son-in-law Paul's fingerprints were found on the knife used to murder Kyla.
Calloway grimaced. Sharon Gardner spoke. Paul, if you are watching this, we want this ordeal to be over for us. We just want to bury Kyla in peace. She broke down in tears and disappeared from view. Senator Lester took the microphone again.
As you can see, this is a devastating time for our family.
Wasn't Paul a member of your family too? Calloway thought.
Now you are no longer leaving him to sink or swim. You are leaving him for the sharks to feed on.
We never thought in our wildest dreams that something like this could happen to us. We have issued our statement, and in doing so, we ask the media to respect our privacy. Thank you for coming.
Senator Lester moved away from the cameras as reporters began shouting questions.
Do you intend to keep running for re-election? One reporter asked.
Senator Lester turned and said,
Even though this is a tough time for us as a family, I will continue to fight for the people of this state. I know there are families who are going through worse times than us. They have lost loved ones to gun violence, gang violence, and many other forms of violence. With health care being underfunded, threats to reduce Social Security, and taxes for the rich being cut, there is still so much work to be done. I won't stop.
Calloway shut the TV off.
I'm in no mood for a campaign speech, he thought.
Chapter 49. Roth had watched the impromptu statement from the Lester family with a scowl on his face. They were trying to distance themselves from Paul. Even Sharon's last name at the bottom of the screen did not read Gardner, but Lester, her maiden name. After the family statement ended, he immediately called Barrows and gave her a piece of his mind. She denied any involvement, but he did not believe her. It was a tactic he would have used if he were in her place. They were pushing Paul into a corner so that he would confess to the crime. Even if he refused, the media would jump on the recent development and roll with it. The jury pool was now tainted because the bias against Paul was going to quickly rise. Roth would have to file a formal request for the judge to move the trial to another city, far away from Milton. In case the judge denied his request, he had to find a way to mitigate the damage that had been done. The first thing he did was call the producer of a local news program. Roth had represented the producer in a sexual harassment case involving him and a female colleague. Roth was able to work out a settlement that satisfied both parties. After speaking to him, the producer was more than willing to accommodate Roth on such short notice. As Roth was hooked up to a microphone, the program host, a woman in her mid-30s with blonde hair and long legs, said, "We didn't have time to prepare cue cards, so I'll let you do most of the talking." Roth gave her a smile. "That's perfectly fine by me." He had come with a prepared statement, and he did not want some eager host to contradict him. The pre-recorded segment would appear later in the day, when the program aired in its allotted time slot. It would not be a live rebuttal to the family statements, but it would still have an impact. When the cameraman gave the signal, the host introduced herself, and then Roth. She then turned to him. "Thank you for giving me this opportunity," he said. "I wanted to speak for my client, Paul Gardner, in order to clear up some misconceptions that have been blatantly distributed to the media. My client is innocent of the crime he has been accused of. Contrary to what the prosecution or anyone else says, he loved his daughter, and he had no motive to harm her. The truth is that the facts don't add up. The prints on the knife found at the scene may belong to my client, but it still does not mean he committed the crime." "Doesn't it?" the host asked. Roth smiled. He had given her an opening, and she took it. "Of course not. It doesn't make sense for my client to kill his daughter in cold blood, then place the murder weapon in his car, and then go back inside his house and take a nap. If he did it, he would be scrambling to clean the crime scene of any evidence that might incriminate him, not be concerned about catching up on his sleep. This speaks volumes about his innocence." "What about the fact that your client was intoxicated when he committed the crime?" she asked. Another easy question, he thought. If he was drunk, as they have repeatedly said in the media, then how did he have the presence of mind to know that he needed to hide the murder weapon? Also, if the crime was committed in a drunken rage, there would have been more blood at the scene. The fact that no drops of blood were found anywhere else in the house also supports my client's innocence. "Do you think, perhaps, that your client might have been set up?" the host asked. Roth paused. "I never considered that before," he thought. "She might be onto something." "That's a strong possibility," he said casually. "We will definitely look into this as time goes on." "Before we end our segment, is there anything you would like to add?" the host asked. Roth looked into the camera. "I would like to say that Mrs. Sharon Gardner," he said, emphasizing her last name, as she was still married, "has gone on TV and accused my client of committing this terrible crime. I would like to ask her this. Where were you on the night your daughter was murdered? Why did you turn off the security cameras that would have shown the real killer and made sure this ordeal could be over for my client so he can be involved in his daughter's burial?" The host smiled. "Thank you, Mr. Roth, for speaking to us." Roth smiled back. "Thank you for having me." The prosecution had served him a fastball, and he had hit it out of the park. Chapter 50. Calloway frowned in dismay.
Reporters had staked out Paul's mother's house, and it looked like they were going to be there for a while. They had brought tents, lawn chairs, and even a Winnebago. After the news broke about his fingerprints being on the knife, the press had descended like vultures. They wanted a glimpse of Paul Gardner, whom they had dubbed the Baby Killer. Calloway thought that was an odd moniker, given Kylo was close to the minimum legal drinking age. But if he thought about it, she was once Paul's baby, and the name given to him was sensational and sure to sell loads of newspapers and magazines. Even the local news channel had been repeating the Gardner story non-stop for the last couple of hours. There was no way Calloway could go through the front door. The press would go ballistic. He was surprised that, so far, his name had not appeared anywhere, even though he was the one who had discovered Sharon Gardner's infidelities. If he was seen meeting with Paul, he would definitely make the 6 o'clock news. While he believed all publicity was good publicity, Paul's case was an exception. Being associated with the Baby Killer was career suicide. He decided to find another way in. The back of the house had a throng of reporters gathered behind the fence surrounding the property, so the only other option available was the neighboring houses on each side. The one on the left had a large Beware of Dog sign on the front lawn. Calloway could not risk getting bitten or have the dog bark, betraying his whereabouts. He chose the house on the right, but instead of going through there, he went through the house next to it. In a single leap, Calloway was up and over the fence gate that led to the backyard. He then hopped the fence and into the next neighbor's yard. He looked around, in case anyone was looking, and hopped the next fence, too. He was now in Paul's mother's backyard. He approached the house and knocked on the back door. Paul's mother appeared in the kitchen. She saw him and immediately put her hand over her mouth to stifle a scream. Calloway waved at her and smiled. Still horrified, she was reaching for the phone when, to Calloway's relief, Paul appeared behind her. He spotted Calloway and took the phone away from his mother. He said something to her which calmed her nerves. Paul then let Calloway in. Once seated in the living room, Calloway waited as Paul's mother made coffee. She thought he was a reporter, and she was about to call 911. "I'm so sorry," she had said to Calloway. "Can I get you something to drink?" "Coffee would be good," Calloway had replied. Calloway watched as Paul stood by the window. Every so often, he would pull the blind aside an inch and peek out at the people trespassing on his mother's front lawn. "We've called the police many times," he said. "They would come push the press off our property, but the moment the cops leave, the reporters would take up position again. Why can't they just leave me alone?" "You're the man of the hour, I'm afraid," Calloway replied. His mother brought Calloway a steaming cup and placed it on the coffee table before him. She also placed a plate filled with cookies. Even with everything happening around her, she was still a good host. When his mother had left the room, Paul turned to him and said, "Why are you here, Mr. Calloway?" "I came to give you this," Calloway said, holding out a USB drive. "What is it?" Paul asked. "They're the images I took of your wife leaving the house. I couldn't give it to you when you were in jail, or else the guards would have taken it," Calloway replied. Calloway preferred film over digital because the images could not be altered. He used to pay a guy to use his darkroom at a film developing studio. Calloway could not trust anyone to do it for him. The images were too sensitive and were for his client's eyes only. But with the advent of digital photography, the guy went out of business. Calloway had to resort to creating his very own darkroom in the bathtub of his apartment, but then he got evicted and that was no longer an option either. He turned to digital photography out of necessity. Paul looked at the USB. "Didn't you already give them to my lawyer?" "I only gave him some. These are the rest of the photos." Paul shook his head. "They are of no use to me now." "I figured I should give them to their rightful owner."
"And also get paid, correct?"
Calloway looked away. He suddenly felt sheepish. "Don't feel bad for me," Paul said with a short smile.
"This isn't your fault. I probably wouldn't be out on bail had it not been for those photos you took.
The judge considered my wife's testimony, to be more precise, her forever-changing testimony, in releasing me. Paul left the room and returned with an envelope.
It was 500, right?
Calloway nodded and placed the envelope in his pocket without counting the money. He stood up and said, "Your brother-in-law dropped by my office, and he offered me a nice sum for them."
"Richard?" Paul asked, surprised.
"Yes.
He's far more dangerous than my wife."
Calloway waited for him to explain.
"My wife's brother and her father run everything for the family. The father and son are very close. They always have been, ever since I've known them. Sharon is spoiled and naive, but Richard and Baron are calculating and ruthless. They will do anything if it benefits the family. The whole thing on TV with Sharon and Baron was most likely Richard's doing. They wanted the public to see me as the bad guy and the family as the victim. I'm just collateral damage in their PR campaign."
"Your daughter is the real victim here," Calloway said. Paul's eyes welled up with tears.
"Yes, you're right. I can't complain about myself when she is gone forever."
Chapter 51. Calloway left through the back door, twice hopped over the neighbor's fences, then walked down the street to where his car was parked. He felt sorry for Paul. He was a prisoner in his mother's house. Calloway almost wondered if being out on bail was such a good idea. At least in prison, you could shut out the noise from the outside. He was approaching his car when a large shadow fell over him. He turned and was face to face with Detective Greg Holt.
"Oh, it's only you," Calloway said, relieved. "I thought it was a reporter."
"What are you doing here?" Holt growled.
"I could ask you the same thing."
"I am keeping an eye on a suspect."
"Paul Gardner?"
"Good deduction."
"Well, you're wasting your time. He isn't going anywhere. Those reporters outside his house will make sure of that."
Calloway squinted as something occurred to him.
"Let me guess. It was you who went to the press about the knife."
"I won't confirm anything."
"You're not denying it either."
"I heard Gardner was no longer a client of yours," Holt said.
"He's not."
"In that case, I would advise that you stay away from him."
"Why is that?"
"He's going down for murder, and you don't want to be too close when he does."
"How can you be so certain he did it?"
"The facts speak for themselves."
Calloway scowled.
"I don't know about the facts, but have you spoken to him?"
"Of course. We had to get a statement from him."
"And in it, he said he didn't do it."
Holt snorted.
"They all do until they are found guilty. You ask any convicted felon, and he'll tell you he is innocent."
"Okay, let me ask you this. When you spoke to him, did he come across as a smart person?"
Holt eyed him.
"Okay, I'll bite. He seemed smart enough."
"Well, he had to be. He built a business that was worth close to $10 million at one point."
"It's not worth that much anymore. In fact, from what I read, it's bleeding cash."
"It's not his fault the economy turned on him."
"What's your point in all of this?" Holt asked.
"For a person who seems smart enough, as you just said, why would he not hide the knife where it can never be found?"
Calloway replied.
"Simple," Holt said. "He never expected he would be caught."
Calloway frowned.
"I doubt that. His wife lived in the very house he supposedly murdered his daughter in. The chance of his crime being discovered was very high."
"In my years of experience, sometimes even geniuses do very dumb things," Holt shot back.
They were silent a moment. Holt said,
"There is something else you failed to consider."
"And what is that?" Calloway said.
"What if he wanted to be caught?"
"Why would he want that?"
"Guilt," Holt said slowly. "He knew what he had done, and he wanted us to catch him."
"Then why not just plead guilty and pay for his crimes?" Calloway asked.
"He might have changed his mind when he saw how long he would end up spending time behind bars. Or his lawyer might have talked him out of it."
"I doubt that very much," Calloway said.
"Why would you say that?"
"I know people like Evan Roth. They only care about winning. If he knew he didn't have a case, he would have convinced his client to take the deal."
Give us time, Calloway, Holt said. We're still building a case against him. Sooner or later, we'll find that one thing that'll convince you and everyone else that Gardner is guilty of murdering his daughter.
Chapter 52. Stan Watterson took a sip from his thermos and then placed it back in the garbage truck cab's cup holder. Stan was 52, married, and the father of two teenage daughters. His wife and kids were his life. He would do anything to provide a good life for them, including picking up garbage in the middle of the night and hauling it to a waste facility. Stan never got a formal education, something he regretted in his life. He dropped out in 10th grade to work for a logging company. He learned to cut trees and then moved on to managing a shift in the company's manufacturing plant. With China's economy exploding, there was a huge demand for lumber. Construction projects were sprouting up all over the country, and Stan's company could not keep up fast enough. They hired more and more labor, and they expanded at a rapid pace. Then the Chinese economy began to falter, and demand quickly fell off. Projects were being abandoned left, right, and center. The impact was felt as far as Stan's company. They had taken on too much debt, and with companies defaulting, they were left with unpaid invoices. They went into receivership and were bought out by a German company. They decided to lay off half the workforce in order to restructure the company and make it profitable again. Stan became a casualty of this. He even lost his pension when the company refused to pay it out. His union took them to court, but lost, as the company was not obligated to continue the plan as part of the takeover. After kissing his dreams of retiring from the lumber company goodbye, Stan, now in his mid-30s, began looking for work again. He drove a taxi, a grocery truck, an excavator for a construction firm, anything to put food on the table. His wife even went back to work during the month Stan could not find employment. He then landed a job with his current employer. PWM, Professional Waste Management, Inc., specialized in collecting bulk waste and non-hazardous materials, which included recyclable and organic materials. Their customers included retail stores, shopping centers, schools, and hospitals. After 10 years with PWM, Stan hoped the company would be his last stop before he retired. He did not want to start knocking on doors again at his age. Stan's route included strip malls and plazas. He had driven the route so many times he knew it like the back of his hand. He took another sip from the thermos. The coffee was still hot and strong, helping to jolt his senses. He needed it this early in the morning. He could not risk falling asleep at the wheel. Next to the thermos was a plastic bag which held his bagel. He grabbed the bagel and took a bite. He should not be eating in his truck, but who would find out? 3 bites later, the bagel was gone. He entered the back of a strip mall that contained 2 restaurants, 1 pharmacy, an optician, and a convenience store. From past experience, he knew the dumpster would not be overloaded with garbage bags. Except for the restaurants, the other 3 businesses hardly produce much garbage. Stan carefully got the dumpster onto the forks and lifted it up to dump its contents into the truck. As the waste emptied, he heard a sound that caught his attention. It did not sound like anything he had heard before. "I'm not sure what that was," he thought. "Gosh, I hope somebody did not toss out something you shouldn't put in a dumpster." He had found rubber tires, paint cans, and even propane gas tanks in the dumpsters. If crushed, these items would contaminate the other garbage and take a ton of work to remove at the processing plant. And in the case of the gas tanks, there was the risk of an explosion. He lowered the dumpster. He got out of the truck's cab and moved to the back of the truck. He grabbed the top ledge of the hopper and pulled himself up. He took a peek inside. Bile rose in the back of his throat. He threw up the bagel. Chapter 53. Holt was at the scene the moment he received the call. He spotted Fisher talking to the garbage truck driver. The man looked visibly ill. The body was identified as belonging to Pedro Catano. He lay among the garbage in the back of the truck, resting at an awkward angle.
His legs were spread apart, and his arms were twisted to the sides. His eyes were closed, but his mouth was open. Blood had caked the right side of his face. Holt believed the bullet must have gone through the left and come out the right. As he leaned into the hopper, he noticed something on Pedro's body. "It's the driver's breakfast," Fisher said, coming up next to him. The moment he saw the body, he threw up.
"Is that bagel?" Holt asked.
"Yep."
"Why don't people chew properly like they taught us back in school?" he griped.
"Don't tell me you chew like 30 times."
"Maybe not that much, but I most certainly don't swallow my food whole."
They stared at Pedro's body in silence. His father would be devastated when they broke the news to him. Holt said,
"How did you know it was Pedro? I don't see any ID on him unless he went inside the hopper."
"There's no way I went in there," she said. "There's no telling what people throw out in their garbage."
"Then how?"
"Simple. I did an online search and several photos came up belonging to a Pedro Catano. I matched one to the body."
"That was simple. So why didn't I think of it?" Holt wondered.
"What did the driver tell you?" he asked.
"He said he picks up the garbage 3 times a week.
"When was the last pickup?" Holt asked.
2 days ago.
A light went on in his head.
"That's the day Kyla Gardner was found murdered."
"Exactly."
"But if the body has been here 2 days, why didn't anyone notice it?"
"I was thinking the same thing, and I have a theory that might answer it. The garbage truck driver must have emptied the dumpster right before the killer arrived and left Pedro's body. The container is almost 6 feet in height, which makes it very deep. No one would know his body was in the container unless they climbed up the side and took a peek inside. Over the next 2 days, people just threw garbage into the dumpster, covering Pedro's body in the process."
"What about the smell? The odor is unmistakable."
Fisher grimaced. "It's a dumpster. What else is it supposed to smell like? Roses?"
"She's got a point," Holt thought.
Fisher said, "I think the timing can't be a coincidence either."
"Timing?" Holt asked.
"The garbage truck driver emptied the container around 1 a.m., which is what he said was his usual pickup time. We think Kyla was murdered between 11:30 p.m. and 2:30 a.m., give or take a couple of minutes. The drive over here is less than 20 minutes, which means..."
Holt's eyes widened. He now understood what he was getting at.
"It means whoever murdered Kyla could have also murdered Pedro."
Chapter 54. The press arrived as soon as news broke of another dead body. Cameramen tried to capture the scene as it unfolded before them. They wanted enough footage for the early morning broadcasts. One man approached Holt and aimed the camera directly in his face. Holt glared at him and he quickly moved away. Holt had no personal issues with the media in general, but at the moment, he just was not in the mood for a close-up. He had not had any sleep, the adrenaline was wearing off, and lethargy was taking over. He worried he might say something on camera he would later regret. The sun had risen over the horizon, and soon there would be light.
"That's good," he thought. "Daylight will help clear my head."
His walk around the strip mall answered one question that had been nagging him since the moment he arrived. Why did the killer choose to dump Pedro's body here and not someplace else? There were no CCTV cameras anywhere on the property. The tenants in the mall may have their own security, but it likely only covered their business. What transpired behind the mall, including the area where the dumpster was situated, would never be known. He spotted Fisher coming his way. She was holding 2 cups in her hand. "It's hot and just the way you like it," she said. He took a sip of the coffee. It was cream, no sugar. His senses suddenly came alive. He took another sip. "They're waiting for a statement," Fisher said, nodding in the direction of the press gathered behind the yellow police tape.
"We should tell them something."
"We should," she agreed. They sipped coffee in silence. Neither had the energy to speak to the press.
"I have a theory," Holt said, "and I know you won't like it."
"I have a feeling I know where you're going with this."
"Paul Gardner killed Pedro Catano," he said.
She shook her head. "Isn't that a bit of a stretch?"
"Just think about it.
Kyla told her father she wanted to get married, and he was fervently opposed to it. Pedro's ex-girlfriend believed Pedro was in love with Kyla. What if Kyla wanted to marry Pedro, and Gardner couldn't accept that his daughter would marry an employee of the family? Employee? Pedro's father has been the family's gardener for decades. Pedro and Kyla grew up together.
I don't know if they grew up together, Fisher said.
Okay, but they played together as kids. Luis said while he worked, Pedro would spend time with Kyla.
Let's say I somewhat agree with you, but I don't think Gardner would kill his daughter for wanting to marry the son of a gardener. He himself came from a humble beginning.
Yes, but you forget one crucial thing, Holt said with a smile.
And what is that?
Kyla was in line to receive a substantial inheritance when she turned 21, which was only a few months away. And she had promised her father that she would help him out because he was under a lot of financial pressure. Gardner may have feared that she would renege on her promise if she married Pedro, or Pedro was only marrying her for her money, and Gardner wanted to stop that from happening.
There's a big flaw in your theory, Fisher said.
How?
Kyla was stabbed, and Pedro was shot. If Gardner did it, why stab one and shoot the other?
Maybe he didn't want the crimes to be linked. Maybe he killed Kyla by accident. Remember, she was strangled first and then stabbed later. And to tie up loose ends, he shot Pedro because, unlike Kyla, he couldn't overpower Pedro, who was taller and younger than him. Shooting him was the easiest way to get rid of him.
Fisher opened her mouth, but then shut it. She hated to admit it, but Holt was beginning to make sense.
Chapter 55. Holt and Fisher looked inside the hopper as Andrea Wakefield examined the body. The medical examiner had run through a series of tests that gave her an indication of the cause of death, time of death, and place of death. The victim definitely died from a gunshot wound to the head, she said. It was most likely at close range. Perhaps the assailant was a foot or two away. The bullet went through the left side of the head and is still lodged in the skull.
Are you saying the bullet did not exit? Holt asked. He was certain that it had.
I can't say with complete accuracy until I open the skull and take a look, Wakefield replied. But I didn't see an exit wound during my initial observation.
What about the blood on the right side of his head? Holt asked.
The force of the bullet was so strong that the impact caused the side of the skull to tear open, causing blood to drain out. If the bullet had exited, you would also see brain tissue.
What about the time of death? Fisher asked. She wanted to move on from the gory details.
Rigor mortis can last up to 72 hours, Andrea replied. But decomposition has started to take effect. It could be due to the environment the body was under. She turned to Holt. You said you believe the victim was covered in garbage bags?
I did, Fisher replied. The driver explained that he only heard the body after some of the garbage and debris was in the hopper. We believe whoever left him here did so after the driver had previously picked up garbage. So the body was at the bottom, and the tenants of the strip mall, unbeknownst to them, kept throwing garbage on it. When the container was flipped over to be emptied, the body ended up on top. I strongly believe if the body was at the top of the garbage, the driver may not have heard the odd noise, as he kept calling it, and would have crushed the body with the compactor.
Thank you, Detective. That explains a lot, Wakefield said. So to answer your question, I believe the time of death to be between 48 hours and 72 hours. Holt looked over at Fisher. He knew she was thinking the same thing.
Pedro was indeed murdered the same night Kyla was.
And place of death? Fisher asked. I took a quick look at the dumpster, Wakefield replied. I did not see any blood, which leads me to believe the victim could not have been shot where his body was eventually discovered.
So he was shot someplace else and dumped here, Holt said.
That would seem like it.
So I guess when we search the hopper, we won't find the murder weapon, he said, more as a statement than a question.
Unless the killer became impatient and left both the body and gun behind for you to find, Wakefield suggested.
Not likely, Holt thought.
Chapter 56. Roth slowed down. He looked around and saw no reporters on the front lawn. Dawn was still breaking, but soon they would be back to resume their positions. Roth was annoyed at being awoken in the middle of a dream. He could not remember what the dream was, but he still did not like having it broken. Roth had contacts at various newspaper outlets. If there was news he needed leaked to the public, he would use them. The reporters got an exclusive breaking story, and he was able to disseminate information without a tracing back to him. This was extremely useful when a judge imposed a gag order that restricted lawyers, prosecutors, law enforcement officials, witnesses, and the jury from talking to the press. Anyone who disobeyed this could be found in contempt. Roth did not like getting on the wrong side of a judge. He saw no real advantage in that, but it still did not prevent him from being found in contempt of court over the years. What the caller told him made Roth jump up in bed. He quickly called Paul, but when there was no answer, he decided to get dressed and drive over. This personal visit would be billed to Paul at a premium rate. Roth rang the doorbell and waited. A few minutes later, a weary-eyed Paul answered the door. He was wearing a robe and no shoes. He squinted and said, "Evan, what are you doing here so early?" "Why don't you pick up your phone?" Roth asked, pushing past him as he stormed inside. In the living room, Roth placed his briefcase on the coffee table and took a seat. "What's going on?" Paul asked, rubbing his eyes.
"Do you know a person by the name of Pedro Quintana?"
"Yes, he's our gardener's son."
"He's dead."
Paul's face turned pale.
"His body was found in a dumpster behind a strip mall," Roth said matter-of-factly.
Paul dropped to the sofa, holding his head.
"If there is something you want to tell me," Roth said, "this would be the right time."
Paul looked up.
"Like what?"
"My contact at one of the newspapers said there is a chance the police will pin Pedro's murder on you."
Paul's eyes widened in disbelief.
"What?"
"She overheard two detectives discussing this. I bet it must be Holt and Fisher."
"They're out to bury me," Paul said. "I saw Detective Holt outside my house."
Roth's eyes narrowed.
"He's following you?"
"I think so."
"Make a note of how many times you see him. I can file a harassment case against him in the department."
"I can't believe Pedro is dead," Paul said, shaking his head. "He was friends with Kyla."
"They were?" Roth asked.
"Yes. Luis Quintana, Pedro's dad, has been the Lesters' family gardener for a long time, way before I came into the family. When they were kids, I used to see Pedro and Kyla running in our backyard."
A thought occurred to Roth. He snapped open his briefcase and rummaged inside.
"Didn't your daughter call Pedro on the day she was murdered?"
"Yes, why?"
"What if he met your daughter that night? They had a disagreement, and he killed your daughter, and then he committed suicide."
"Didn't you say his body was found behind a strip mall?"
"So?"
"You mean he shot himself in the dumpster? That doesn't make sense."
"Let the prosecution tear our theory apart. Our job is to place doubt in the jury's mind regarding your guilt."
"I thought your job was to prove my innocence."
Roth smiled.
"That's where you're wrong. In the eyes of the law, you are innocent until proven guilty. And if the case goes to trial, we're not interested if the jury thinks you are innocent. We only care that they find you not guilty."
Chapter 57. Calloway was awake even before the sun was up. He was not sure why, but he had a fitful night. He was a sound sleeper. No matter what was going on around him, he would be passed out like a drunken sailor. There was something bothering him, but he could not put his finger on what it was. He tried to go over the events of the past couple of days,